You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. Botox is widely known for its remarkable ability to do away with wrinkles, but medical experts say the cosmetic staple also has the capacity to treat neurological issues. In fact, in 2016, new guidelines were published that established this elixir of youth as an effective treatment for various neurological disorders, ranging from strokes to migraines. Dr. Stephen Asher is the medical director of St. Luke's Movement Disorders Program, and he uses Botox to treat certain conditions in patients. Dr. Asher is joining us live in studio to talk more. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Gemma. My pleasure.
So first, explaining what Botox is.
Sure. So Botox is an acronym for botulinum toxin. Botulinum toxins are derived from a series of bacteria that live in the soil widely and elsewhere. There are two species of Clostridium. There's Clostridium botulinus and Clostridium tetani. Tetany is tetanus, for which
okay.
we get immunized. Clostridium botulinum is the source of botulinum toxin that we use medically. There, within that family of the botulinum toxins, there are seven subspecies of toxin, of which we use typically two, A and B. So that's kind of what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's an enzyme and it's a protease. And it is used for the bacteria for their own purposes. But when we ingest it, it causes the side effects that we call botulism,
okay.
a disease.
So then you mean, most people, as I mentioned, know it for, you know, you inject it to get rid of wrinkles. It's more cosmetic. So how did it go from being cosmetic to really being used more as a medical tool? Or was it vice versa? Was it used for medicine first and then cosmetics?
It could be apocryphal, but the story is that largely women mm-hmm. were getting wrinkle-free and said, you know what, I stopped having headaches. And so
interesting.
A study was constructed by the headache group at UC San Diego, and they devised a protocol, which we still use to this day, injecting Botox in logical areas of the face and neck, and proving that it is effective. It turns out that it has been used since the late 1970s for treating lazy eye or strabismus in children. They, to my knowledge, those children did not note that they stopped having migraine. They're probably too young to get migraine. But
right.
that it goes back that far. So that was a neuromuscular application before
okay.
the use in the prevention of migraine.
So what does Botox do? If you get it, I mean, how does it work?
Right. So when we use it medically, we're talking about doses that are far, far smaller than the doses that are necessary to cause botulism. That's important to emphasize.
Right.
We're not going
right.
to cause people to stop breathing, hopefully. But botulism, the toxin works by being transported from the injection site into the nerves in the area. When it's transported into the intracellular aspect of a neural junction, the so-called synapse, the toxin prohibits the release of neurotransmitters at the synapse.
So does it basically relax the muscle? Is that kind of what it does?
It prohibits the muscle from contracting.
Okay.
It is important to note that it's sort of an equal opportunity toxin. It also involves sensory neurons. Even though we don't induce anesthesia with it, that is probably a very important part of some of its attributes in both migraine and in disorders of movement. So it's a motor and a sensory compound, huh. even though the larger part of it is the motor as we see it, and thus we're wrinkle-free.
I'm speaking with Dr. Stephen Asher. He's the medical director at St. Luke's Movement Disorders Program, and we're talking about the use of Botox for medical issues. So let's talk about some cases that you actually use. And one of them in particular is a person who is a drummer, a professional drummer that you treat. So talk to me about this case.
Sure. So a very accomplished professional musician who noted that he was having increasing troubles, not with stage fright, but with inability to drum with one hand in front of a paying audience. He could practice all day, all night without limitation, but as soon as he got in front of a crowd, he would note that his dominant right hand would start to pull back such that he could no longer contact the drumhead with the stick and held in his right hand. And he demonstrated to me what was happening, and I could see that he was having involuntary contraction of the forearm extensor muscles, the one on the back of the arm where people get tennis elbow and so forth. So this, what I recognized as being what's called musician's dystonia or task-specific dystonia, sort of analogous to the writer's cramp that we all get in a three-hour written examination, but much worse. So this was impacting his livelihood. So identifying the cause, identifying the muscles, we then went about injecting very small amounts of Botox. To put it in context, for migraine, we used between 155 and 195 units. And him, I was using about 17 and a half units into his forearm. And voila, in about 2 weeks, he was able to play in front of a crowd. The Botox would last about 3 months, so he's coming back for his repeated Botox injections on a periodic basis, but playing successfully.
And as you said, this is task-specific. So with something like this, is that because it's an overuse of the muscle? I mean, do you see that? Because when you, especially when you said something like writer's cramp or something like that.
Yes, that's a deep question. Why would overuse induce involuntary motor contraction? And I think it does. Golfers get the yips when they're trying to putt. It's the same thing. Robert Schumann, the pianist, could not hit the ivories properly after a time. And I think what's happening is we're overdeveloping a circuit or a loop, and then it takes on a life of its own. And we retrain it to behave properly by weakening those muscles, and so that the muscle groups that work to balance muscle contraction assume a more proper role and allow, for example, the hand to be held in a normal position.
So can Botox also be used for people like Parkinson's patients? Are you using it in that regard at all then?
About 30% of Parkinson's patients will have accompanying dystonia, particularly in their feet. They develop foot cramps and intorsion of the feet. So yes, we do use Botox typically in the legs in a subset of patients with Parkinson's. But interestingly, rather often the dystonic symptoms in Parkinson's disease will respond to the medicines we use for Parkinson's disease, even though we think about those as opposite kind of neurologic phenomenon.
So you were recently in a story that KTVB, the NBC television station in Boise, did a feature on a ninth grade student in Boise, and you happened to treat her. Talk to me about her case and why she and her family came to you.
So this is a youngster with a genetic dystonia, a generalized dystonia. It's called rapid onset Parkinson's dystonia. It's a neurologic movement disorder that develops acutely over the course of days and weeks and then progresses slowly. It may stop progressing or it may continue. Time will tell. We were able to do genetic testing and identify the specific gene defect that she had. Prior to identifying that and launching into some independent forms of therapy, because of the severe dystonic postures of her feet and legs, we actually had used Botox distally in both of her legs and into the intrinsic muscles of her feet. Needless to say, doing that to a 12-year-old was an exercise in terror for both of us.
I bet.
but anyway, we did it. It worked, but we arrived at better therapy. She has a brain-stimulating system placed now, and that is working relatively well.
Because something like this, as you said, Botox wears off. So if you have a recurring issue, it's not like one and you're done.
Right. It is not one and done. It interestingly, however, does have an accumulative beneficial effect over time. So we are inducing changes in the sensory and motor loops within the nervous system such that sometimes the intervals between injections can be spread out to as long as every 6 or 8 months.
So what types of patients do you normally see when it comes to using Botox as a medical treatment?
I would say that to this day still, the commonest application is in the prevention of migraine. It works extremely well. In my practice, however, the and the commonest dystonic movement disorder is so-called cervical dystonia or wry neck, where people have their head and neck twisted in various different directions. And Botox is very effective and widely used for that dystonic disorder. The more focal dystonias, such as musicians' dystonia and dystonic writer's cramp, they're far less common, but respond equally well.
Well, and what's fascinating is that it's only been, 10 or 11 years since the FDA actually approved the use of Botox for migraines.
Right. It's been a rapid growth in terms of seeing applications for this drug. And I think there are going to be many coming forward in coming years, particularly with respect to its ability to serve as an analgesic as well as a mild relaxant.
Really? Mm-hmm. Now, why is that?
Yes, it's a good question. Just to kind of put this in sort of scientific context, the question was asked, how does it work to diminish perception of pain? And in an animal model, in a rat model, an irritant was injected into, for example, the right rear foot of a rat, and they developed a particular withdrawal reaction to pain. What was noted was in the opposite foot, the same reduction in sensitivity to the application of pain was noted. Therefore, the effect of Botox is moving from one extremity to the other. Hmm. And the only way it can do that is to travel up the nerves through the spinal cord back down the other leg.
And the nerves are connected.
They're all part of a circuit.
So give me an example of what that would potentially look like for a person coming into you. Like what kind of pain would they be presenting with?
Well, it's currently being looked at for the treatment of what's called tic douloureux or trigeminal neuralgia, which is a very, very painful facial neurologic disorder in which there's abnormal pain emanating from the large sensory nerve to the face. The face, as we all know, is a very sensitive area to touch. And when that misfires, it produces excruciating, sharp, jabbing pain in the face. So Botox is being used to in an experimental fashion right now to see if it will attenuate trigeminal neuralgia, which is a purely sensory phenomenon. There's no motor branches of the trigeminal nerve to speak of. So that's one area of application that I think we'll be seeing coming forward because the other treatments are a little more difficult.
And is it being used for some cases of Tourette's syndrome as well?
It can be used for the tics that are part of Tourette's syndrome. And Tourette's syndrome, of course, consists of involuntary motor...
Like movement, right?
Movement and vocal tics. It's the combination of those two that is defined as Tourette's syndrome. The vocalizations, that's a more cerebral process, and I don't think we can expect Botox to have a big impact on that. But the motor tics, the tongue thrusts or the head tossing or the hand raising, all of those aspects could respond since they're focal dystonias.
Well, this is a fascinating conversation, and I really appreciate you taking some time out and talking to us about this.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Our guest today, Dr. Stephen Asher, the medical director of St. Luke's Movement Disorders Program. We've been talking today about Botox, but how it's used to help with neurological issues in patients. Again, thanks so much for the conversation.
Thank you.
Up next, a new market is making its debut in the Wood River Valley. I'm Gemma Gaudet. You're listening to Idaho Matters.